You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 25th of July 2015 on Monocle 24. No mountain too high, no ocean too wide for magazine publishing. From mountaineering in India to Pan-Pacific print from New Zealand via Taipei. A truly global whip round as we get into some serious rustling today on The Stack. On the programme today, we'll be getting the industry insights of our editor-in-chief as the pink colossus of newspaper publishing, London's venerable Financial Times, is bought by Tokyo media giant The Nikkei. We'll then venture to India and to New Delhi as one editor sets his sights on the mountains.
A mountain doesn't have a nationality. A rock is a rock, a river is a river, a jungle is a jungle. I don't think that somebody in the US who truly enjoys climbing only wants to read about American climbers. I think that era has passed.
We hear from some young New Zealanders based in Taiwan who have an eye for the conceptual.
Here we focus on the visual art, on experimental music, but really we're just, you know, looking to develop a readership which isn't slotting into any particular category.
All that and more besides coming up on this edition of The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis programme. You are listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Now let's start the show, as we often like to do, by talking to Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, who joins us on the line now. And Tyler, really this week there's only one place to start, and that was this pretty extraordinary story, a late-breaking one as it was at the time, of the Nikkei purchase of the Financial Times Group. I wonder, first of all, just rolling back a couple of days, what your initial response was when you learned that our friends at Nikkei were in the frame to take over the FT?
Well, I have to say, I wasn't fully surprised, because I'm not sure if it was a passing comment. And some of our listeners will know, Tom, but a year ago, we were actually just concluding our own deal with the Nikkei. And of course, they only bought a very small portion of our business. They didn't buy us outright, as they've done with the Financial Times. But there was this comment that the Nikkei was sitting on a real war chest of cash, and that they were, of course, looking at a big target. And it did slip that, you know, what would be, you know, the absolute prize for them would be a franchise like the Financial Times. So it didn't surprise me, but there was so much focus over the last year. Would it be Bloomberg? Would it be Thomson? Later on, we heard about Axel Springer coming into the mix. But as we saw, Nikkei succeeded.
And Tyler, we'll talk a bit more about the sort of print implications in a moment, but just from the corporate side, do you think this is a significant moment? Because we've had Shinzo Abe talking about, you know, sleeping giants of Japanese business, and him being keen for them to widen their horizons and actually maybe invest some of the pools of cash they have in concerns overseas. Could this be a bit of a breaking point?
It is, and I think that there, you know, across a variety of sectors, we've seen a number of high profile and in some ways also some below the radar acquisitions. But there's no question that probably over the last 2 years, you've seen corporate Japan very much on a move. But I think that this will be, you know, it's great news to, of course, Shinzo Abe, all of those people in the foreign ministry in Japan who also want to see Japan exercise their soft power. And, you know, this is a media buy, this is a cultural buy, and what it does is it gives a Japanese media company of scale, yeah, a real proper global foothold, and not only just a foothold, it also gives them real influence in the English language.
Well, Tyler, let's talk about print specifically then. You've talked about the kind of cultural aspect almost, the media landscape broadly. What about print? What does this mean for the print landscape here in the UK, globally? We know, you know, the FT is a truly international title. What do you think the actual, you know, what will readers see, or what will consumers of the FT's digital content see that might tell them that Nikkei is now the parent?
I don't think you'd notice anything right away, but I foresee investment. One thing I think that surprised all of us when we hooked up with the Nikkei last year is just the scale of the place. This is a misunderstood brand in many ways. You know, it's just not represented, but you recognize, you know, within Japan, its global reach, though, is huge. You know, scores and scores of correspondents, you know, very big bureaus. What I'm always amazed, I think they've got two dedicated football correspondents based in London. just covering Japanese football players based in Europe. So, you know, this shows you sort of the depth of editorial resource that's there. So I would see, and this is just a guess, but I would think that suddenly you might see more FT correspondents, you know, being assigned or finding desks in bureaus where, you know, till now the FT has not had a presence. And of course, it'll probably allow for synergies, you know, where there's duplication of real estate in certain cities, you know, maybe, you know, FT correspondents are going to be taking up desks in Nikkei bureaus. You know, that is a possibility. And that's only going to show up on page. I think, you know, just this being a program about print, I think a key point is, this is a paper which on a good day is selling close to 4 million newspapers a day. So I think, you know, it might present a bit of a culture shift as well. By the way, I'm not starting a trucking magazine either. but there's a truck in the background, Tom. No, but I think what it will reveal, though, and maybe exercise a bit of a cultural shift, that this is a media company where, you know, Nikkei sort of really, they believe in paper. And in many ways, paper is what facilitated the real mountain of cash that they were sitting on, the $1.4-ish billion that, you know, that they were able to pay in cash to Pearson. You know, this has come from a very, very strong print legacy. So I think that might correct some of this sort of digital runaway thinking that, you know, many see that the FT has.
And Tyler, maybe just a final thought from you on this. It's interesting, you know, people have been talking about the price paid, whether there's been a premium. We think around £850 million or so. Do you think the fact that you had, you know, various big players jockeying, Axel Springer, whether, you know, Bloomberg, Thomson Reuters, how far their interests went, we're not quite sure. That in itself is also quite a good sign, isn't it? It shows that there is still a lot of interest when you get a title that stands for something, that has a clear editorial line, that's popular, that has lots of subscribers, whether it's print or online. People will still want to buy into that, literally and metaphorically.
Absolutely. And I think what this revealed, though, is it also, I think, a pretty good deal all around. There's going to be speculation, of course, over the coming days. Did the Nikkei overpay for this? Or, as you said, the Financial Times is an extraordinary brand. And the fact that, you know, when we see all kinds of crazy valuations around various digital enterprises that do not have the brand power, they don't have the brand loyalty or the revenue streams that the FT has, I think that this, you know, certainly is a good signal for the market. And, you know, I think probably Pearson is very happy with the price that they got. And I think that, you know, I'm sure Nikkei probably has a few spare yen jingling around in their pocket as well.
The insights there of Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé from Italy. Tyler, thanks for joining us on the show as ever. We will catch up with you very soon. This is The Stack. Coming up next, we'll be delving into stacks of magazines from all points, north and south, east and west, right here on The Stack.
We should have breakfast together, and lunch, and coffee, and cake, and a forced beer, or even an Aperol Spritz at sunset. And we know just the perfect spot. Come and join us at our London cafe that's just around the corner from our Midori HQ and also close to the Monocle shop. While you have a great flat white made with all press coffee, you'll no doubt bump into one of our team and get to hear all the latest from the Monocle world. You can also pick up the latest issue of the magazine. Oh, and we also have space for hosting private lunches and events too. Join us at 18 Chiltern Street in London and also at our outpost in the Hankyu Men's Department Store in Tokyo. We look forward to seeing you.
This is The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. It used to be that magazines were produced for a specific geographic market, and that was pretty much that. But as borders open up, traditional boundaries shut down, and that too is true in the publishing world. A standout example of this is the Outdoor Journal, a two-year-old magazine published out of New Delhi, but aimed very much for a global audience of outdoor enthusiasts. Mountain climbers, kayakers, skiers, and more from all around the world. As founder Apoorva Prasad puts it, a mountain doesn't have a nationality. He caught up with Monocle's New Delhi correspondent, Arti Bettigeri.
So I moved to India in 2012 when I'd been living outside India. I was living in France for about 5 years, and I was living in the US before that. And I kind of came to India with the idea of creating a global brand. What I wanted to do was create something that was of global value, standards, quality. And India was, for me, the first market. partly because India was a growing economy and is a growing economy, and didn't have, I mean, we're a white space, we're in a white space here because it doesn't have an outdoors media, an outdoor lifestyle media. So in that sense, it was almost a very easy value proposition to kind of do a startup in India, which had an existing audience for the adventure outdoor lifestyle category in media, but it didn't have a media catering to them. But the intention was always, once we've sort of created for India and doing it to global standards, take it outside India, because what we do is unique. It has a USP for global markets as well, which is kind of where we are right now, since we are planning to launch in the US. I mean, we already reach out to an international audience, and we need to now expand on that.
So tell me a bit about your content mix. The Outdoor Journal tells me that it's a pretty outdoorsy magazine.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it's we cover everything that would be the gamut of the outdoors lifestyle and the active lifestyle space, including everything from, say, you know, fitness and health and the right kind of food to eat, to kayaking and climbing and hiking and camping and mountaineering. So it's that range of activities and lifestyle. I mean, that's the only word to use, because it does sort of talk about what you should eat, which is better for you and for the environment. It talks about activities like yoga, and it talks about going outdoors. So that's the spirit behind the Outdoor Journal. It's something that makes you want to live a better lifestyle, which is both healthier for you and for the environment. And I think that's where all of us are headed globally.
It's certainly a pretty interesting concept for India, where traditionally, you know, outdoor pursuits aren't really that popular. People tend to live more sedentary indoor lifestyles. I'm starting to see now there's a little bit more, there's a growing interest in and awareness of outdoor pursuits. Is this partially why you started up at this time?
So I don't think it's wholly accurate to say that India hasn't had an outdoors audience. The Himalayan Club was set up in the 1920s. There have been mountaineering institutes in India set up by the government. I believe there's 15 of them, mountain or outdoor adventure institutes, for decades. Tenzing Norgay was officially an Indian. So, you know, my grandfather was an outdoorsy person. He used to spend a lot of time in jungles and exploring and things. And India's had wildlife parks for a very long time, and protection for wildlife. So I think there are a lot of Indians for a very long time who've been doing outdoorsy things. However, it's not been mainstreamed in the sense that it wasn't very much in your face. Part of the reason has been that there's been no media for it. So it's this sort of chicken or egg thing, right? It's did the climber come first, or did the climbing magazine come first? I think the climbers and the outdoors people have been around for a long, long time, but the media wasn't there. That's one. The second part of it, I think in terms of the income levels, those have been rising. So it's become an acceptable pursuit to spend your time on as a leisure pursuit. So today, with income levels rising, it's become easier to access. And with the opening up of the economy, it's become easier to access some of these things, which makes that visibility so much more. And yes, of course, with you have a growing population, you have a younger population, you have a population that has more money. So it's almost an obvious thing that there will be more people doing more outdoors things. It's as that percentage of the population changed, I'm not entirely sure yet.
Now, your magazine has only been around for about 2 years, a little bit more than 2 years. You're entering your third year. Vitally, you've just agreed to a deal with Barnes & Noble to be your distribution partner in the US, which is pretty huge for an Indian brand. What does this actually mean for you?
So the intention had always been for us to be present in international markets, and I always envisioned the Outdoor Journal partly as sort of, with my background as a TCK, a third culture kid, who didn't really feel, I mean, at the age of 34, I've lived now in India, in France, and in America, but also having left India in 99, once you know the phrase, you can never really come back home. Once you've left, India's changed dramatically in the last 10, 15 years, and I don't think it's the same place anymore. And I see this with a lot of people. Once I kind of got into that international community, I began to realize there are a lot of people globally who believe in a more international outlook. And in the 21st century, I think, is a post-national century. I hope it is, at least, despite, of course, the way things are in Europe with immigration barriers and other things. But I think people have understood that borders are fundamentally artificial constructs, and nationality is fundamentally, for me at least, an artificial construct. Now, you're talking about outdoors, or the outdoor lifestyle, you're talking about an activity like climbing or trekking or camping. Now, a mountain doesn't have a nationality. A rock is a rock, a river is a river, a jungle is a jungle. Therefore, people who enjoy these activities or these pursuits, I believe, also understand that. And once you start to create content around it that appeals to somebody who's fundamentally an outdoors person, I think they're outdoorsy first, and you know, the nationality comes second. Now, I don't think that somebody in the US who truly enjoys climbing only wants to read about American climbers. I think that era has passed. And what we bring on to the table is really high quality content from all over the world. We have access to athletes anywhere in the world. And today, the internet also allows us, has democratized that access. And with the internet, I think it was very important for other media companies to realize that national media really didn't have a role. It was international media was the next step. And that's what we're bringing to the table, really. It's we've created an international magazine, and the goal always was to appeal to that audience set that sort of was looking internationally for whether it's adventure travel experiences or inspirational figures and characters from the outdoor lifestyle world.
And that was Apoorva Prasad and Monocle's R.T. Bettigheri in New Delhi talking about the Outdoor Journal. This is The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Born from the spirit of pure anarchy some 11 years ago by two brothers, Mark and Ron Hansen, White Fungus magazine is a publication that originated in Wellington, New Zealand, but is now based in Taiwan. Throughout the pages, both Taiwanese and New Zealand culture are incorporated into a rich tapestry which extends across the world. But what kind of effect can uprooting a magazine's base from one country to another have on its content? Earlier in the week, we caught up with Ron Hansen, who talked to us from his base in Taiwan.
Since the beginning, every magazine has started with a non-fiction article, an in-depth non-fiction article, usually a history piece. A writer in New Zealand, Tim Bollinger, has written the majority of those pieces. In this issue, he's written an article called The Bone Collectors, which is about the early days of sort of zoological discovery in colonial New Zealand and the beginnings of the museums, which it turns out were funded in large part by raiding the ancestral graves of indigenous Maori and selling off a lot of preserved heads, which got repatriated around the world, including many in England, and you know, and over time were actually brought back. So it's quite an interesting look at this sort of clique of colonial scientists who had this scene and the sort of devious activities they got up to fund their activities. So it's quite a fascinating look at something that you know, most people probably aren't going to know anything about. We started in 2004, as originally it was intended to be a one-off photocopied sort of piece of propaganda, really, that was protesting the building of an inner city bypass, which subsequently destroyed the arts community and the arts district in Wellington. So we did this thing on a photocopier and was just talking about the history of the area, a bit of politicking, wrapped each copy in Christmas paper and hurled them anonymously through the entrances of businesses in the city. So after we got a really strong response, we thought, well, let's continue this and evolve it more towards our interests. And it's just grown gradually over almost 11 years, from a photocopied handout to something which was printed but staple bound, and then eventually to perfect bound magazine with quite high production values, at least compared to how we started. The first issue was focused on a very specific part of the world, Wellington, New Zealand, and even a very specific part of that city, whereas now it's really global in reach, although it has a strong Asia focus. The other major thing, of course, is that in 2009 we moved from Wellington to Taiwan, Taichung City, but we're also very heavily involved in Taipei. But the connection's still huge. I mean, if you look at the current issue, you know, there's a pretty good chunk of it, maybe 25 to 30% of it is still New Zealand content. You know, we cover a lot of New Zealand history. There are New Zealand advertisers, and the magazine is distributed in New Zealand. So in a way, it's ironic that we really needed to leave New Zealand in order to be able to maintain our involvement in New Zealand culture. We did a residency in San Francisco at Cadist Art Foundation, which was really huge for us. Cadist Art Foundation has a residency where they bring over two people from a magazine to spend a month in the city and absorb the city and create content for the next issue from the Bay Area. And that was huge for us because we were able to really develop some networks there, build the profile, we held a couple of events. And so the current issue has some content from the Bay Area, including a history of the experimental music scene there and the artist Scott Arford, and there's different writers from San Francisco that we've involved. So I think that's quite an interesting thing. You know, there's so many residencies that go on at art spaces, but when you think about it, if instead of bringing an artist in, or a conventional artist, if you bring in a magazine maker, the sort of impact that can potentially have is quite far-reaching. I hope that more art spaces, galleries, think about this kind of thing, because it's really been amazing for us, and I hope that we've been able to contribute something to San Francisco through this. In terms of starting this magazine, we've set ourselves an almost impossible task of trying to establish a magazine which isn't based around demographics. There's a heavy focus on the visual art, on experimental music, but really we're just, you know, looking to develop a readership which isn't slotting into any particular category of just people who are curious, who are interested in intellectually challenging, culturally challenging material, and are interested in being surprised with each issue. And so I think that's why it's taken us 11 years just to get to this point of developing this sort of idiosyncratic audience, just taking a little bit from here, a little bit from there. We've had a huge amount of media coverage in Taiwan, and that's really increased the sales we get here. But the current issue, we printed 4,000 copies. So it's on sale in around 25 countries or so. Our distributor's really targeted. We've been really fortunate. It's a new company, White Cirque, which has been started by Stuart White, who is the circulation manager for the Dazed Group titles, and Kelly Clark, who formerly worked with Comag. And they've really put a lot of time into White Fungus, so we feel pretty fortunate. It's quite targeted distribution, and we're getting into some really nice niche stores which seem to really value the magazine. So we feel pretty fortunate to be where we're at in terms of reaching a targeted audience that's being receptive to what we're doing. Our readership is really just spread out all over the world. It's quite surprising where some of the interest comes from.
That was Ron Hansen, co-founder of White Fungus, and issue 14 of the magazine is out right now.
Do you ever feel like you've missed out on something? Have you been on the road? Miss the latest world news? Then catch up with The Recap, the best of the week's cutting-edge reports, comment, news and features from all the flagship shows on Monocle 24. Join us every Saturday from 1400 London time or via the Monocle 24 app.
This is The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Before we end the show, it's absolutely raced by this week. There's just enough time for our almost weekly bit of magazine indulgence, the slot we devote to the personal print preferences of our editors, contributors and friends here at Monocle. Last week we heard from Japan and our photo director, Poppy Shibamoto, who spoke in praise of the classic title Karashi no Techo. Now it's the turn of our Hong Kong bureau chief, Aisha Spears, who now tells us about New York-based food magazine Gather.
Gather Journal is something that I found because the two lovely ladies that founded it are girls that I know. And so they threw this launch party in New York a few years ago for the first issue. They used to work at another independent magazine in downtown New York, decided to set up something together. So one of them's an editor, one of them's a creative director, and they both love food. And so what they did was launch this quite brilliant food magazine called Gather Journal. The look and feel of Gather is, it's really solid. That sounds like a weird thing to say, but it's one of those things that's printed on really quite beautiful paper. It's matte. It's something which is sturdy. It's not big format. It's not small format. It's not a dissimilar size, actually, to Monocle magazine. And it's really beautifully art directed. So the art director is a girl called Michelle, and she has this incredible eye. And so what it really is something that you want to keep. And I think that's one of the things that you want with a magazine. You know, it's not in any way disposable. And the girls really have designed it in order to be something that people stack along their shelves. And so what I do have at home in my, you know, in my kitchen, I have my cookbooks and then I have all of my Gather journals because this is a food magazine. And it's a magazine that people are encouraged to cook from, not simply read and kind of pour over reviews of new restaurants. It's something which is designed for people to host dinner parties with. And that's what you do find. You find people who actually have these Gather dinner parties where they're cooking something from every section of the magazine. The magazine is designed in themes. So the first theme was called Float. It then went to Traces. The most recent theme is Spectrum. And what this means is not only aesthetically, but also in terms of the food, everything is designed with some nod towards this theme. So if you look at the most recent issue, Spectrum, it's got a very colourful front cover. And then the actual piece of food on the front of it is just a simple piece of white toast with hundreds and thousands sprinkled all over it. And what the girls do is they've designed this thing where you have bits and pieces, you know, have different courses laid out through the magazine. They cook it all themselves. I mean, it's a very, very small team. They have a great food stylist. They do it in an apartment. That might have changed now because I haven't spoken to them in a little while. It might be a little bit more high-end because they've been so successful. But what it means is that it's very much something which is fun, it's themed, but it's not in any way pretentious. It's very easy for other people to attain that kind of exciting way of looking at food and serving food and eating food. Obviously, in the last few years, we've seen a number of really good food magazines gaining popularity, even if they're young and old. So everything from sort of Bon Appetit, which had a redesign in the States and is an incredibly good magazine that does everything from show recipes to give restaurant reviews to magazines like Kinfolk, which are a little bit more lifestyle based. And then you have Gather. Gather really is a food magazine. But I think people are choosing to identify themselves in their homes alongside these magazines. So to be honest, I don't think it actually has much of a competitor. I think it really does something very unique. But if you go into somebody's home and you can see that in their kitchen they have Gather, you'd probably guess that they are into their food. And so I think people will brand themselves with magazines like Gather.
That was Aisha Spears, Monocle's Hong Kong bureau chief there, speaking in praise of New York gastronomy title Gather. And that brings us to the end of this 152nd edition of The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. The episode was produced, as ever, by David Pleasant and beautifully woven together by Claire Urban. Comments or queries are welcome, info@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next week. From me and the team, though, this time, goodbye.